Disc 3. Chapter 10. The offices of Edgerton, Forbes and Wilborough were in Bloomsbury, in one of those imposing and dignified squares which have as yet not felt the wind of change. Their brass plate was suitably worn down to illegibility. The firm had been going for over 100 years, and a good proportion of the landed gentry of England were their clients. There was no Forbes in the firm any more, and no Wilborough. Instead, there were Atkinsons, father and son, and a Welsh Lloyd, and a Scottish Macalister. There was, however, still an Edgerton, descendant of the original Edgerton. This particular Edgerton was a man of 52, and he was adviser to several families which had in their day been advised by his grandfather, his uncle, and his father. At this moment he was sitting behind a large mahogany desk in his handsome room on the first floor, speaking kindly but firmly to a dejected-looking client. Richard Edgerton was a handsome man, tall, dark, with a touch of grey at the temples, and very shrewd grey eyes. His advice was always good advice, but he seldom minced his words. "Quite frankly, you haven't got a leg to stand upon, Freddy," he was saying. "Not with those letters you've written."
"You don't think," Freddy murmured dejectedly.
"No, I don't," said Edgerton. "The only hope is to settle out of court. It might even be held that you've rendered yourself liable to criminal prosecution."
"Oh, look here, Richard. That's carrying things a bit far."
There was a small, discreet buzz on Edgerton's desk. He picked up the telephone receiver with a frown. "I thought I said I wasn't to be disturbed." There was a murmur at the other end. Edgerton said, "Oh, yes. Yes, I see. Ask her to wait, will you?" He replaced the receiver and turned once more to his unhappy-looking client. "Look here, Freddy," he said. "I know the law, and you don't. You're in a nasty jam. I'll do my best to get you out of it, but it's going to cost you a bit. I doubt if they'd settle for less than 12,000.
12,000? The unfortunate Freddy was aghast. "Oh, I say! I haven't got it, Richard."
"Well, you'll have to raise it, then. There are always ways and means. If she'll settle for 12,000, you'll be lucky. And if you fight the case, it'll cost you a lot more."
"You lawyers," said Freddy. "Sharks, all of you."
He rose to his feet.
"Well," he said, "do your bloody best for me, Richard, old boy."
He took his departure, shaking his head sadly. Richard Edgerton put Freddy and his affairs out of his mind and thought about his next client. He said softly to himself, "The Honourable Elvira Blake. I wonder what she's like." He lifted the receiver. "Lord Frederick's gone. Send up Miss Blake, will you?" As he waited, he made little calculations on his desk pad. "How many years since? She must be 15, 17, perhaps even more than that. Time went so fast. Coniston's daughter," he thought, "and Bess's daughter. I wonder which of them she takes after." The door opened. The clerk announced Miss Elvira Blake, and the girl walked into the room. Edgerton rose from his chair and came towards her. In appearance, he thought, she did not resemble either of her parents. Tall, slim, very fair, Bessie's colouring, but none of Bessie's vitality, with an old-fashioned air about her, though that was difficult to be sure of, since the fashion in dress happened at the moment to be ruffles and baby bodices. "Well, well," he said, as he shook hands with her, "this is a surprise. Last time I saw you, you were 11 years old. Come and sit here." He pulled forward a chair, and she sat down. "I suppose," said Elvira, a little uncertainly, "that I ought to have written first. Written and made an appointment. Something like that, but I really made up my mind very suddenly, and it seemed an opportunity since I was in London."
"And what are you doing in London?"
"Having my teeth seen to."
"Beastly things, teeth," said Edgerton.
give us trouble from the cradle to the grave. But I am grateful for the teeth, if it gives me an opportunity of seeing you. Let me see now. You've been in Italy, haven't you, finishing your education there at one of these places all girls go to nowadays?
Yes, said Elvira, the Contessa Martinelli. But I've left there now for good. I'm living with the Melfords in Kent until I make up my mind if there's anything I'd like to do.
Well, I hope you'll find something satisfactory. You're not thinking of a university or anything like that.
No, said Elvira. I don't think I'd be clever enough for that. She paused before saying, I suppose you'd have to agree to anything if I did want to do it.
Edgerton's keen eyes focused sharply. I am one of your guardians and a trustee under your father's will, yes, he said. Therefore you have a perfect right to approach me at any time. Elvira said thank you politely. Edgerton asked, Is there anything worrying you?
No, not really. But you see, I don't know anything. Nobody's ever told me things. One doesn't always like to ask.
He looked at her attentively. You mean things about yourself?
Yes, said Elvira. It's kind of you to understand. Uncle Derek, she hesitated.
Derek Luscombe, you mean?
Yes. I've always called him Uncle.
I see.
He's very kind, said Elvira, but he's not the sort of person who ever tells you anything. He just arranges things and looks a little worried in case they mightn't be what I'd like. Of course, he listens to a lot of people, women, I mean, who tell him things, like Contessa Martinelli. He arranges for me to go to schools or to finishing places.
And they haven't been where you wanted to go?
No, I didn't mean that. They've been quite all right. I mean, they've been more or less where everyone else goes.
I see.
But I don't know anything about myself. I mean, what money I've got, and how much, and what I could do with it if I wanted.
In fact, said Edgerton with his attractive smile, you want to talk business. Is that it? Well, I think you're quite right. Let's see. How old are you? 16? 17?
I'm nearly 20.
Oh, dear. I'd no idea.
You see, explained Elvira, I feel all the time that I'm being shielded and sheltered. It's nice in a way, but it can get very irritating.
It's an attitude that's gone out of date, agreed Edgerton, but I can quite see that it would appeal to Derek Luscombe.
He's a dear, said Elvira, but very difficult, somehow, to talk to seriously.
Yes, I can see that that might be so. Well, how much do you know about yourself, Elvira, about your family circumstances?
I know that my father died when I was 5, and that my mother had run away from him with someone else when I was about 2. I don't remember her at all. I barely remember my father. He was very old and had his leg up on a chair. He used to swear. I was rather scared of him. After he died, I lived first with an aunt or a cousin or something of my father's until she died, and then I lived with Uncle Derek and his sister. But then she died, and I went to Italy. Uncle Derek has arranged for me now to live with the Melfords, who are his cousins, and very kind and nice, and have 2 daughters about my age.
You're happy there?
I don't know yet. I've barely got there. They're all very dull. I really wanted to know how much money I've got.
So it's financial information you really want?
Yes, said Elvira. I've got some money, I know. Is it a lot?
Edgerton was serious now. Yes, he said. You've got a lot of money. Your father was a very rich man. You were his only child. When he died, the title and the estate went to a cousin. He didn't like the cousin, so he left all his personal property, which was considerable, to his daughter. To you, Elvira. You are a very rich woman, or will be when you are 21.
You mean I'm not rich now?
Yes, said Edgerton, you are rich now. But the money is not yours to dispose of until you are 21 or marry. Until that time, it is in the hands of your trustees. Luscombe, myself, and another. He smiled at her. We haven't embezzled it or anything like that. It's still there. In fact, we've increased your capital considerably by investments.
How much will I have?
At the age of 21, or upon your marriage, you will come into a sum which at a rough estimate would amount to 600,000 or 700,000 pounds.
That is a lot, said Elvira, impressed.
Yes, it is a lot. Probably it is because it is such a lot that nobody has ever talked to you about it much.
He watched her as she reflected upon this. Quite an interesting girl, he thought. Looked an unbelievably milk-and-water miss, but she was more than that, a good deal more. He said with a faintly ironic smile,
"Does that satisfy you?"
She gave him a sudden smile.
"It ought to, oughtn't it?"
"Rather better than winning the pools," he suggested. She nodded, but her mind was elsewhere. Then she came out abruptly with a question.
"Who gets it if I die?"
"As things stand now, it would go to your next of kin."
"I mean, I couldn't make a will now, could I? Not until I was 21. That's what someone told me."
"They were quite right."
"That's really rather annoying. If I was married and died, I suppose my husband would get the money."
"Yes."
"And if I wasn't married, my mother would be my next of kin and get it. I really seem to have very few relations. I don't even know my mother. What is she like?"
"She's a very remarkable woman," said Edgerton shortly. "Everybody would agree to that."
"Didn't she ever want to see me?"
"She may have done. I think it's very possible that she did. But having made, in certain ways, rather a mess of her own life, she may have thought that it was better for you that you should be brought up quite apart from her."
"Do you actually know that she thinks that?"
"No. I don't really know anything about it."
Elvira got up.
"Thank you," she said. "It's very kind of you to tell me all this."
"I think perhaps you ought to have been told more about things before," said Edgerton.
"It's rather humiliating not to know things," said Elvira. "Uncle Derek, of course, thinks I'm just a child."
"Well, he is not a very young man himself. He and I, you know, are well advanced in years. You must make allowances for us when we look at things from the point of view of our advanced age."
Elvira stood looking at him for a moment or two.
"But you don't think I'm really a child, do you?" she said shrewdly, and added, "I expect you know rather more about girls than Uncle Derek does. He just lived with his sister."
Then she stretched out her hand and said very prettily, "Thank you so much. I hope I haven't interrupted some important work you had to do," and went out. Edgerton stood looking at the door that had closed behind her. He pursed up his lips, whistled a moment, shook his head, and sat down again, picked up a pen, and tapped thoughtfully on his desk. He drew some papers towards him, then thrust them back and picked up his telephone.
"Miss Cordell, get me Colonel Luscombe, will you? Try his club first and then the Shropshire address."
He put back the receiver. Again he drew his papers towards him and started reading them, but his mind was not on what he was doing. Presently his buzzer went.
"Colonel Luscombe is on the wire now, Mr. Edgerton."
"Right, put him through. Hello, Derek. Richard Edgerton here. How are you? I've just been having a visit from someone you know. A visit from your ward."
"From Elvira?"
Derek Luscombe sounded very surprised.
"Yes."
But why? What on earth? What did she come to you for? Not in any trouble?"
"No, I wouldn't say so. On the contrary, she seemed rather, well, pleased with herself. She wanted to know all about her financial position.
You didn't tell her, I hope, said Colonel Luscombe in alarm.
Why not? What's the point of secrecy?
Well, I can't help feeling it's a little unwise for a girl to know that she is going to come into such a large amount of money.
Somebody else will tell her that if we don't. She's got to be prepared, you know. Money is a responsibility.
Yes, but she's so much of a child still.
Are you sure of that?
What do you mean? Of course she's a child.
I wouldn't describe her as such. Who's the boyfriend?
I beg your pardon?
I said, who's the boyfriend? There is a boyfriend in the offing, isn't there?
No, indeed, nothing of the sort. What on earth makes you think that?
Nothing that she actually said, but I've got some experience, you know. I think you'll find there is a boyfriend.
Well, I can assure you, you're quite wrong. I mean, she's been most carefully brought up. She's been at very strict schools. She's been in a very select finishing establishment in Italy. I should know if there was anything of that kind going on. I dare say she's met one or two pleasant young fellows and all that, but I'm sure there's been nothing of the kind you suggest.
Well, my diagnosis is a boyfriend, and probably an undesirable one.
But why, Richard, why? And what do you know about young girls?
Quite a lot, said Edgerton dryly. I've had 3 clients in the last year, 2 of whom were made wards of court, and the 3rd one managed to bully her parents into agreeing to an almost certainly disastrous marriage. Girls don't get looked after the way they used to be. Conditions are such that it's very difficult to look after them at all.
But I assure you Elvira has been most carefully looked after.
The ingenuity of the young female of the species is beyond anything you could conjecture. You keep an eye on her, Derek. Make a few inquiries as to what she's been up to.
Nonsense! She's just a sweet, simple girl.
What you don't know about sweet, simple girls would fill an album. Her mother ran away and caused a scandal, remember, when she was younger than Elvira is today. As for old Coniston, he was one of the worst rips in England.
You upset me, Richard. You upset me very much.
You might as well be warned. What I didn't quite like was one of her other questions. Why is she so anxious to know who'd inherit her money if she dies?
It's queer you're saying that, because she asked me that same question.
Did she now? Why should her mind run on an early death? She asked me about her mother, by the way.
Colonel Luscombe's voice sounded worried as he said, I wish Bess would get in touch with the girl.
Have you been talking to her on the subject? To Bess, I mean?
Well, yes. Yes, I did. I ran across her by chance. We were staying in the same hotel, as a matter of fact. I urged Bess to make some arrangements to see the girl.
What did she say? Asked Edgerton curiously.
Refused, point blank. She more or less said that she wasn't a safe person for the girl to know.
Looked at from one point of view, I don't suppose she is, said Edgerton. She's mixed up with that racing fellow, isn't she?
I've heard rumours.
Yes, I've heard them too. I don't know if there's much in it, really. There might be, I suppose. That could be why she feels as she does. Bess's friends are strong meat from time to time. But what a woman she is, eh, Derek? What a woman.
Always been her own worst enemy, said Derek Luscombe gruffly.
A really nice conventional remark, said Edgerton. Well, sorry I bothered you, Derek, but keep a lookout for undesirables in the background. Don't say you haven't been warned. He replaced the receiver and drew the pages on his desk towards him once more. This time he was able to put his whole attention on what he was doing. Chapter 11 Mrs. McCrae, Canon Pennyfather's housekeeper, had ordered a Dover sole for the evening of his return,
The advantages attached to a good Dover sole were manifold. It need not be introduced to the grill or frying pan until the cannon was safely in the house. It could be kept until the next day, if necessary. Canon Pennefather was fond of Dover sole, and if a telephone call or telegram arrived saying that the cannon would, after all, be elsewhere on this particular evening, Mrs. McRae was fond of a good Dover sole herself. All, therefore, was in good trim for the cannon's return. The Dover sole would be followed by pancakes. The sole sat on the kitchen table. The batter for the pancakes was ready in a bowl. All was in readiness. The brass shone, the silver sparkled, not a minuscule of dust showed anywhere. There was only one thing lacking. The cannon himself. The cannon was scheduled to return on the train arriving at 6:30 from London. At 7 o'clock he had not returned. No doubt the train was late. At 7:30 he still had not returned. Mrs. McRae gave a sigh of vexation. She suspected that this was going to be another of these things. 8 o'clock came, and no cannon. Mrs. McRae gave a long, exasperated sigh. Soon, no doubt, she would get a telephone call, though it was quite within the bounds of possibility that there would not even be a telephone call. He might have written to her. No doubt he had written to her, but had probably omitted to post the letter. "Dear, dear," said Mrs. McRae. At 9 o'clock, she made herself 3 pancakes with the pancake batter. The sole she put carefully away in the frigid air.
"I wonder where the good man's got to now," she said to herself.
She knew by experience that he might be anywhere. The odds were that he would discover his mistake in time to telegraph her or telephone her before she retired to bed.
"I shall sit up until 11 o'clock, but no longer," said Mrs. McRae.
10:30 was her bedtime, and extension to 11 she considered her duty. But if at 11 there was nothing, no word from the cannon, then Mrs. McRae would duly lock up the house and betake herself to bed. It cannot be said that she was worried. This sort of thing had happened before. There was nothing to be done but wait for news of some kind. The possibilities were numerous. Canon Pennefather might have got on the wrong train and failed to discover his mistake until he was at Land's End or John O'Groats. Or he might still be in London, having made some mistake in the date, and was therefore convinced he was not returning until tomorrow. He might have met a friend or friends at this foreign conference he was going to and been induced to stay out there, perhaps, over the weekend. He would have meant to let her know, but had entirely forgotten to do so. So, as has been already said, she was not worried. The day after tomorrow, his old friend Archdeacon Simmons was coming to stay. That was the sort of thing the canon did remember. So no doubt he himself or a telegram from him would arrive tomorrow, and at latest he would be home on the day after, or there would be a letter. The morning of the day after, however, arrived without a word from him. For the first time Mrs. McRae began to be uneasy. Between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. she eyed the telephone in a doubtful manner. Mrs. McRae had her own fixed views about the telephone. She used it and recognized its convenience, but she was not fond of the telephone. Some of her household shopping was done by telephone, though she much preferred to do it in person, owing to a fixed belief that if you did not see what you were being given, a shopkeeper was sure to try and cheat you. Still, telephones were useful for domestic matters. She occasionally, though rarely, telephoned her friends or relations in the near neighbourhood. To make a call of any distance, or a London call, upset her severely. It was a shameful waste of money. Nevertheless, she began to meditate facing that problem. Finally, when yet another day dawned without any news of him, she decided to act. She knew where the canon was staying in London.
Bartram's Hotel. A nice old-fashioned place. It might be as well, perhaps, if she rang up and made certain inquiries. They would probably know where the canon was. It was not an ordinary hotel. She would ask to be put through to Miss Gorringe. Miss Gorringe was always efficient and thoughtful. The canon might, of course, return by the 12:30. If so, he would be here any minute now. But the minutes passed, and there was no canon. Mrs. McRae took a deep breath, nerved herself, and asked for a call to London. She waited, biting her lips and holding the receiver clamped firmly to her ear.
"Bertram's Hotel at your service," said a voice. "I would like, if you please, to speak to Miss Gorringe," said Mrs. McRae. "Just a moment. What name shall I say?" "It's Canon Pennyfarrer's housekeeper, Mrs. McRae. Just a moment, please."
Presently the calm and efficient voice of Miss Gorringe came through. "Miss Gorringe here. Did you say Canon Pennyfarrer's housekeeper?"
"That's right, Mrs. McRae."
"Oh, yes, of course. What can I do for you, Mrs. McRae?"
"Is Canon Pennyfarrer staying at the hotel still?"
"I'm glad you've rung up," said Miss Gorringe. "We have been rather worried as to what exactly to do."
"Do you mean something's happened to Canon Pennyfarrer? Has he had an accident?"
"No, no, nothing of that kind. But we expected him back from Lucerne on Friday or Saturday."
That'd be right."
"But he didn't arrive."
"Well, of course, that wasn't really surprising. He had booked his room on. Booked it, that is, until yesterday. He didn't come back yesterday or send any word, and his things are still here. The major part of his baggage. We hadn't been quite sure what to do about it." "Of course," Miss Gorringe went on hastily, "we know the canon is, well, somewhat forgetful sometimes.
You may well see that.
It makes it a little difficult for us. We are so fully booked up. His room is actually booked for another guest." She added, "You have no idea where he is?"
With bitterness, Mrs. McRae said,
"The man might be anywhere." She pulled herself together. "Well, thank you, Miss Gorringe." "Anything I can do?" Miss Gorringe suggested helpfully.
"I dare say I'll hear soon enough," said Mrs. McRae.
She thanked Miss Gorringe again and rang off. She sat by the telephone, looking upset. She did not fear for the canon's personal safety. If he had had an accident, she would by now have been notified. She felt sure of that. On the whole, the canon was not what one would call accident-prone. He was what Mrs. McRae called to herself one of the scatty ones. And the scatty ones seemed always to be looked after by a special providence. Whilst taking no care or thought, they could still survive even a panda crossing. No, she did not visualise Canon Pennyfarrer as lying groaning in a hospital. He was somewhere, no doubt, innocently and happily prattling with some friend or other. Maybe he was abroad still. The difficulty was that Archdeacon Simmons was arriving this evening, and Archdeacon Simmons would expect to find a host to receive him. She couldn't put Archdeacon Simmons off because she didn't know where he was. It was all very difficult, but it had, like most difficulties, its bright spot. Its bright spot was Archdeacon Simmons. Archdeacon Simmons would know what to do. She would place the matter in his hands. Archdeacon Simmons was a complete contrast to her employer. He knew where he was going and what he was doing, and was always cheerfully sure of knowing the right thing to be done and doing it. A confident cleric. Archdeacon Simmons, when he arrived, to be met by Mrs. McRae's explanations, apologies, and perturbation, was a tower of strength. He, too, was not alarmed. "Now, don't you worry, Mrs. McRae," he said in his genial fashion as he sat down to the meal she had prepared for his arrival. "We'll hunt the absent-minded fellow down. Ever heard that story about Chesterton? D.K. Chesterton, you know, the writer. Wired to his wife when he'd gone on a lecture tour, 'I'm at Crewe Station, where ought I to be?'" He laughed. Mrs. McRae smiled dutifully. She did not think it was very funny, because it was so exactly the sort of thing that Canon Pennefather might have done. "Ah," said Archdeacon Simmons with appreciation, "one of your excellent veal cutlets. You're a marvellous cook, Mrs. McRae. I hope my old friend appreciates you." Veal cutlets, having been succeeded by some small castle puddings with a blackberry sauce, which Mrs. McRae had remembered as one of the Archdeacon's favourite sweets, the good man applied himself in earnest to the tracking down of his missing friend. He addressed himself to the telephone with vigour and a complete disregard for expense, which made Mrs. McRae purse her lips anxiously, although not really disapproving, because definitely her master had got to be tracked down. Having first dutifully tried the canon's sister, who took little notice of her brother's goings and comings, and, as usual, had not the faintest idea where he was or might be, the archdeacon spread his net farther afield. He addressed himself once more to Bertram's hotel, and got details as precisely as possible. The canon had definitely left there on the early evening of the 19th. He had with him a small BEA handbag, but his other luggage had remained behind in his room, which he had duly retained. He had mentioned that he was going to a conference of some kind at Lucerne. He had not gone direct to the airport from the hotel. The commissionaire, who knew him well by sight, had put him into a taxi and had directed it, as told by the canon, to the Athenaeum Club. And that was the last time that anyone at Bertram's hotel had seen Canon Pennefather. Oh, yes, a small detail. He had omitted to leave his key behind, but had taken it with him. It was not the first time that that had happened. Archdeacon Simmons paused for a few minutes' consideration before the next call. He could ring up the air station in London. That would no doubt take some time. There might be a short cut. He rang up Dr. Weisgarten, a learned Hebrew scholar who was almost certain to have been at the conference. Dr. Weisgarten was at his home. As soon as he heard who was speaking to him, he launched out into a torrent of verbiage consisting mostly of disparaging criticism of two papers that had been read at the conference in Lucerne. "Most unsound, that fellow Hogaroff," he said. "Most unsound. How he gets away with it, I don't know. Fellow isn't a scholar at all. Do you know what he actually said?" The archdeacon sighed and had to be firm with him. Otherwise, there was a good chance that the rest of the evening would be spent in listening to criticism of fellow scholars at the Lucerne conference. With some reluctance, Dr. Weisgarten was pinned down to more personal matters.
"Pennefather," he said. "Pennefather? He ought to have been there. Can't think why he wasn't there. Said he was going, told me so only a week before when I saw him at the Athenaeum."
"You mean he wasn't at the conference at all?"
"That's what I just said. He ought to have been there."
"Do you know why he wasn't there? Did he send an excuse?"
"How should I know? He certainly talked about being there. Yes, now I remember, he was expected. Several people remarked on his absence, though he might have had a chill or something. It's very treacherous weather."
He was about to revert to his criticisms of his fellow scholars, but Archdeacon Simmons rang off. He had got a fact, but it was a fact that for the first time awoke in him an uneasy feeling. Canon Pennefather had not been at the Lucerne conference. He had meant to go to that conference. It seemed very extraordinary to the Archdeacon that he had not been there. He might, of course, have taken the wrong plane, though on the whole BEA were pretty careful of you and shepherded you away from such possibilities. Could Canon Pennifather have forgotten the actual day that he was going to the conference? It was always possible, he supposed. But if so, where had he gone instead? He addressed himself now to the air terminal. It involved a great deal of patient waiting and being transferred from department to department. In the end, he got a definite fact. Canon Pennifather had booked as a passenger on the 2140 plane to Lucerne on the 18th, but he had not been on the plane.
"We're getting on," said Archdeacon Simmons to Mrs. McCrae, who was hovering in the background. "Now, let me see. Who shall I try next?"
"All this telephoning will cost a fearful lot of money," said Mrs. McCrae.
I'm afraid so, said Archdeacon Simmons. "But we've got to get on his track, you know. He's not a very young man."
"Oh, sir, you don't think there's anything could really have happened to him?"
"Well, I hope not." "I don't think so, because I think you'd have heard if so. He, always had his name and address on him, didn't he?"
"Oh, yes, sir. He had cards on him. He'd have letters, too, and all sorts of things in his wallet."
"Well, I don't think he's in a hospital, then," said the Archdeacon. "Let me see. When he left the hotel, he took a taxi to the Athenaeum. I'll ring them up next."
Here he got some definite information. Canon Pennifather, who was well known there, had dined there at 7:30 on the evening of the 19th. It was then that the Archdeacon was struck by something he had overlooked until then. The aeroplane ticket had been for the 18th, but the Canon had left Bertram's hotel by taxi to the Athenaeum, having just mentioned he was going to the Lucerne conference, on the 19th. Light began to break. "Silly old ass," thought Archdeacon Simmons to himself, but careful not to say it aloud in front of Mrs. McCrae.
"Got his dates wrong. The conference was on the 19th, I'm sure of it. He must have thought that he was leaving on the 18th. He was one day wrong."
He went over the next bit carefully. The Canon would have gone to the Athenaeum. He would have dined. He would have gone on to Kensington Air Station. There, no doubt, it would have been pointed out to him that his ticket was for the day before, and he would then have realized that the conference he was going to attend was now over.
"That's what happened," said Archdeacon Simmons. "Depend upon it."
He explained it to Mrs. McCrae, who agreed that it was likely enough.
Then what would he do?
"Go back to his hotel," said Mrs. McCrae.
"He wouldn't have come straight down here, gone straight to the station, I mean."
"Not if his luggage was at the hotel. At any rate, he would have called there for his luggage."
"True enough," said Simmons. "All right. We'll think of it like this. He left the airport with his little bag, and he went back to the hotel, or started for the hotel at all events. He might have had dinner, perhaps. No, he dined at the Athenaeum. All right. He went back to the hotel, but he never arrived there."
He paused a moment or two, and then said doubtfully,
"Or did he? Nobody seems to have seen him there. So, what happened to him on the way?"
"He could have met someone," said Mrs. McCrae doubtfully.
"Yes, of course, that's perfectly possible. Some old friend he hadn't seen for a long time. He could have gone off with a friend to the friend's hotel or the friend's house. But he wouldn't have stayed there 3 days, would he? He wouldn't have forgotten for 3 whole days that his luggage was at the hotel. He'd have rung up about it. He'd have called for it. Or, in a supreme fit of absent-mindedness, he might have come straight home.
3 days silence. That's what's so inexplicable. If he had an accident...
Yes, Mrs. McRae, of course that's possible. We can try the hospitals. You say he had plenty of papers on him to identify him. I think there's only one thing for it.
Mrs. McRae looked at him apprehensively.
I think, you know, said the Archdeacon gently, that we've got to go to the police.
Chapter 12. Miss Marple had found no difficulty in enjoying her stay in London. She did a lot of things that she had not had the time to do in her hitherto brief visits to the capital. It has to be regretfully noted that she did not avail herself of the wide cultural activities that would have been possible to her. She visited no picture galleries and no museums. The idea of patronizing a dress show of any kind would not even have occurred to her. What she did visit were the glass and china departments of the large stores and the household linen departments. And she also availed herself of some marked-down lines in furnishing fabrics. Having spent what she considered a reasonable sum upon these household investments, she indulged in various excursions of her own. She went to places and shops she remembered from her young days, sometimes merely with the curiosity of seeing whether they were still there. It was not a pursuit that she had ever had time for before, and she enjoyed it very much. After a nice little nap after lunch, she would go out and, avoiding the attentions of the commissionaire if possible, because he was so firmly imbued with the idea that a lady of her age and frailty should always go in a taxi, she walked towards a bus stop or tube station. She had bought a small guide to buses and their routes, and an underground transport map, and she would plan her excursion carefully. One afternoon she could be seen walking happily and nostalgically round Evelyn Gardens or Onslow Square, murmuring softly, "Yes, that was Mrs. Van Tillen's house. Of course it looks quite different now. They seem to have remodelled it. Dear me, I see it's got 4 bells. 4 flats, I suppose. Such a nice old-fashioned square this always was." Rather shamefacedly, she paid a visit to Madame Tussaud, a well-remembered delight of her childhood. In Westbourne Grove she looked in vain for Bradley's. Aunt Helen had always gone to Bradley's about her sealskin jacket. Window shopping in the general sense did not interest Miss Marple, but she had a splendid time rounding up knitting patterns, new varieties of knitting wool, and such like delights. She made a special expedition to Richmond to see the house that had been occupied by great-uncle Thomas, the retired admiral. The handsome terrace was still there, but here again each house seemed to be turned into flats. Much more painful was the house in Lowndes Square, where a distant cousin, Lady Meridew, had lived in some style. Here a vast skyscraper building of modernistic design appeared to have arisen. Miss Marple shook her head sadly, and said firmly to herself, "There must be progress, I suppose. If Cousin Ethel knew, she'd turn in her grave, I'm sure." It was on one particularly mild and pleasant afternoon that Miss Marple embarked on a bus that took her over Battersea Bridge. She was going to combine the double pleasure of taking a sentimental look at Prince's Terrace Mansions, where an old governess of hers had once lived, and visiting Battersea Park. The first part of her quest was abortive. Miss Ledbury's former home had vanished without trace, and had been replaced by a great deal of gleaming concrete. Miss Marple turned into Battersea Park. She had always been a good walker, but had to admit that nowadays her walking powers were not what they were. Half a mile was quite enough to tire her. She could manage, she thought, to cross the park and go out over Chelsea Bridge and find herself once more on a convenient bus route, But her steps grew gradually slower and slower, and she was pleased to come upon a tea enclosure situated on the edge of the lake. Teas were still being served there in spite of the autumn chill. There were not many people today, a certain amount of mothers and prams and a few pairs of young lovers. Miss Marple collected a tray with tea and two sponge cakes. She carried her tray carefully to a table and sat down. The tea was just what she needed. Hot, strong, and very reviving. Revived, she looked round her. And her eyes stopping suddenly at a particular table, she sat up very straight in her chair. Really, a very strange coincidence. Very strange indeed. First the Army and Navy stores, and now here. Very unusual places those particular two people chose. But no, she was wrong. Miss Marple took a second and stronger pair of glasses from her bag. Yes, she had been mistaken. There was a certain similarity, of course, that long, straight blonde hair. But this was not Bess Sedgwick. It was someone years younger. Of course, it was the daughter, the young girl who had come into Bertram's with Lady Selina Hayes's friend, Colonel Luscombe. But the man was the same man who had been lunching with Lady Sedgwick in the Army and Navy stores, no doubt about it. The same handsome, hawk-like look, the same leanness, the same predatory toughness, and, yes, the same strong, virile attraction. "It's bad," said Miss Marple. "Bad all through, cruel, unscrupulous. I don't like seeing this. First the mother, now the daughter. What does it mean?" It meant no good. Miss Marple was sure of that. Miss Marple seldom gave anyone the benefit of the doubt. She invariably thought the worst, and 9 times out of 10, so she insisted, she was right in doing so. Both these meetings, she was sure, were more or less secret meetings. She observed now the way these two bent forward over the table until their heads nearly touched, and the earnestness with which they talked. The girl's face... Miss Marple took off her spectacles, rubbed the lenses carefully, then put them on again. Yes, this girl was in love, desperately in love, as only the young can be in love. But what were her guardians about to let her run about London and have these clandestine assignments in Battersea Park? A nicely brought-up, well-behaved girl like that. Too nicely brought-up, no doubt. Her people probably believed her to be in some quite other spot. She had to tell lies. On her way out, Miss Marple passed the table where they were sitting, slowing down as much as she could without its being too obvious. Unfortunately, their voices were so low that she could not hear what they said. The man was speaking, the girl was listening, half pleased, half afraid. Planning to run away together, perhaps, thought Miss Marple. She's still under age. Miss Marple passed through the small gate in the fence that led to the sidewalk of the park. There were cars parked along there, and presently she stopped beside one particular car. Miss Marple was not particularly knowledgeable over cars, but such cars as this one did not come her way very often, so she had noted and remembered it. She had acquired a little information about cars of this style from an enthusiastic great-nephew. It was a racing car. Some foreign make, she couldn't remember the name now. Not only that, she had seen this car, or one exactly like it, seen it only yesterday in a side street close to Bertram's hotel. She had noticed it not only because of its size and its powerful and unusual appearance, but because the number had awakened some vague memory, some trace of association in her memory. Fan 2266. It had made her think of her cousin, Fanny Godfrey, Poor Fanny, who stuttered, and who had said, "I have got two spots." She walked along and looked at the number of this car. Yes, she was quite right. Fan 2266. It was the same car. Miss Marple, her footsteps growing more painful every moment, arrived deep in thought at the other side of Chelsea Bridge, and by then was so exhausted that she hailed the first taxi she saw with decision. She was worried by the feeling that there was something she ought to do about things. But what things, and what to do about them? It was all so indefinite. She fixed her eyes absently on some news boards. "Sensational developments in train robbery," they ran. "Engine driver's story," said another. Really, Miss Marple thought to herself, every day there seemed to be a bank hold-up, or a train robbery, or a wage-pay snatch. Crime seemed to have got above itself. Chapter 13. Vaguely reminiscent of a large bumblebee, Chief Inspector Fred Davy wandered around the confines of the Criminal Investigation Department, humming to himself. It was a well-known idiosyncrasy of his, and caused no particular notice except to give rise to the remark that Father was on the prowl again. His prowling led him, at last, to the room where Inspector Campbell was sitting behind a desk with a bored expression. Inspector Campbell was an ambitious young man, and he found much of his occupation tedious in the extreme. Nevertheless, he coped with the duties appointed to him, and achieved a very fair measure of success in doing so. The powers that be approved of him, thought he should do well, and doled out from time to time a few words of encouraging commendation. "Good morning, sir," said Inspector Campbell respectfully when Father entered his domain. Naturally, he called Chief Inspector Davy Father behind his back, as everyone else did, but he was not yet of sufficient seniority to do such a thing to his face. "Anything I can do for you, sir?" he inquired.
"La la, boom, boom," hummed the Chief Inspector, slightly off key. "Why must they call me Mary when my name's Miss Gibbs?"
After this rather unexpected resurrection of a bygone musical comedy, he drew up a chair and sat down. "Busy?" he asked. "Moderately so."
"Got some disappearance case or other on, haven't you? To do with some hotel or other. What's the name of it now? Bertram's, is that it?"
"Yes, that's right, sir. Bertram's Hotel."
"Contravening the licensing hours? Call girls?"
"Oh, no, sir," said Inspector Campbell, slightly shocked at hearing Bertram's Hotel being referred to in such a connection. "Very nice, quiet, old-fashioned place."
"Is it now?" said Father. "Yes, is it now? Well, that's interesting, really."
Inspector Campbell wondered why it was interesting. He did not like to ask, as tempers in the upper hierarchy were notoriously short since the mail train robbery, which had been a spectacular success for the criminals. He looked at Father's large, heavy, bovine face, and wondered, as he had once or twice wondered before, how Chief Inspector Davy had reached his present rank, and why he was so highly thought of in the department. "All right in his day, I suppose," thought Inspector Campbell. "But there are plenty of go-ahead chaps about who could do with some promotion once the dead wood is cleared away." But the dead wood had begun another song, partly hummed, with an occasional word or two here and there.
"Tell me, are there any more at home like you?" intoned Father, and then in a sudden falsetto, "A few kind, sir, and nicer girls you never knew."
"Now, no. Let's see, I've got the sexes mixed up. Floridora.
That was a good show, too.
I believe I've heard of it, sir, said Inspector Campbell.
Your mother sang you to sleep in the cradle with it, I expect, said Chief Inspector Davy. Now then, what's been going on at Bertram's Hotel? Who has disappeared, and how, and why?
A Canon Pennyfather, sir. Elderly clergyman.
Dull case, eh?
Inspector Campbell smiled. Yes, sir, it is rather dull in a way.
What did he look like?
Canon Pennyfather?
Yes. You've got a description, I suppose?
Of course. Campbell shuffled papers and read, Height, 5'8", large thatch of white hair, stoops, and he disappeared from Bertram's Hotel. When?
About a week ago. November 19th.
And they've just reported it.
Took their time about it, didn't they?
Well, I think there was a general idea that he would turn up.
Any idea what's behind it? Asked Father. Has a decent, God-fearing man suddenly gone off with one of the church warden's wives? Or does he do a bit of secret drinking? Or has he embezzled the church funds? Or is he the sort of absent-minded old chap who goes in for this sort of thing?
Well, from all I can hear, sir, I should say the latter. He's done it before.
What? Disappeared from a respectable West End hotel?
No, not exactly that. But he's not always returned home when he was expected. Occasionally he's turned up to stay with friends on a day when they haven't asked him, or not turned up on the date when they had asked him, that sort of thing.
Yes, said Father. Yes, well, that sounds very nice and natural and all according to plan, doesn't it?
When exactly did you say he disappeared?
Thursday, November 19th.
He was supposed to be attending a congress at... He bent down and studied some papers on his desk. Oh, yes, Lucerne. Society of Biblical Historical Studies. That's the English translation of it. I think it's actually a German society.
And it was held at Lucerne?
The old boy, I suppose he is an old boy.
63, sir, I understand. The old boy didn't turn up. Is that it?
Inspector Campbell drew his papers towards him and gave Father the ascertainable facts insofar as they had been ascertained.
Doesn't sound as though he'd gone off with a choir boy, observed Chief Inspector Davy.
I expect he'll turn up all right, said Campbell, but we're looking into it, of course. Are you, particularly interested in the case, sir? He could hardly restrain his curiosity on this point.
No, said Davy thoughtfully. No, I'm not interested in the case. I don't see anything to be interested about in it.
There was a pause. A pause which clearly contained the words, well then, with a question mark after it, from Inspector Campbell, which he was too well trained to utter in audible tones.
What I'm really interested in, said Father, is the date. And Bertram's Hotel, of course.
It's always been very well conducted, sir. No trouble there.
That's very nice, I'm sure, said Father. He added thoughtfully, I'd rather like to have a look at the place.
Of course, sir, said Inspector Campbell. Any time you like. I was thinking of going round there myself.
I might as well come along with you, said Father. Not to butt in, nothing like that, but I'd just rather like to have a look at the place. And this disappearing archdeacon of yours, or whatever he is, makes a rather good excuse.
No need to call me sir when we're there. You throw your weight about. I'll just be your stooge.
Inspector Campbell became interested. Do you think there's something that might tie in there, sir? Something that might tie in with something else?
There's no reason to believe so, so far, said Father. But you know how it is. One gets, I don't know what to call them,
whims, do you think?
Bertram's hotel somehow sounds almost too good to be true. He resumed his impersonation of a bumblebee with a rendering of Let's All Go Down the Strand. The two detective officers went off together, Campbell looking smart in a lounge suit, he had an excellent figure, and Chief Inspector Davy carrying with him a tweedy air of being up from the country. They fitted in quite well. Only the astute eye of Miss Gorringe, as she raised it from her ledgers, singled them out and appreciated them for what they were. Since she had reported the disappearance of Canon Pennyfather herself, and had already had a word with a lesser personage in the police force, she had been expecting something of this kind. A faint murmur to the earnest-looking girl assistant, whom she kept handy in the background, enabled the latter to come forward and deal with any ordinary inquiries or services, while Miss Gorringe gently shifted herself a little farther along the counter and looked up at the two men. Inspector Campbell laid down his card on the desk in front of her, and she nodded. Looking past him to the large tweed-coated figure behind him, she noted that he had turned slightly sideways and was observing the lounge and its occupants with an apparently naive pleasure at beholding such a well-bred, upper-class world in action. "Would you like to come into the office?" said Miss Gorringe. "We can talk better there, perhaps." "Yes, I think that would be best."
"Nice place you've got here,"
said the large, fat, bovine-looking man, turning his head back towards her.
"Comfortable,"
he added, looking approvingly at the large fire. "Good old-fashioned comfort." Miss Gorringe smiled with an air of pleasure. "Yes, indeed, we pride ourselves on making our visitors comfortable," she said. She turned to her assistant. "Will you carry on, Alice? There is the ledger. Lady Jocelyn will be arriving quite soon. She's sure to want to change her room as soon as she sees it, but you must explain to her we are already full up. If necessary, you can show her number 340 on the third floor and offer her that instead. It's not a very pleasant room, and I'm sure she'll be content with her present one as soon as she sees that."
"Yes, Miss Gorringe. I'll do just that, Miss Gorringe.
And remind Colonel Mortimer that his field glasses are here. He asked me to keep them for him this morning. Don't let him go off without them."
"No, Miss Gorringe."
These duties accomplished, Miss Gorringe looked at the two men, came out from behind the desk, and walked along to a plain mahogany door with no legend on it. Miss Gorringe opened it, and they went into a small, rather sad-looking office. All three sat down. "The missing man is Canon Pennyfather, I understand," said Inspector Campbell. He looked at his notes. "I've got Sergeant Waddell's report. Perhaps you'll tell me in your own words just what occurred."
"I don't think that Canon Pennyfather has really disappeared in the sense in which one would usually use that word," said Miss Gorringe. "I think, you know, that he's just met someone somewhere, some old friend or something like that, and has perhaps gone off with him to some scholarly meeting or reunion or something of that kind on the continent. He is so very vague."
"You've known him for a long time?"
"Oh, yes. He's been coming here to stay for, let me see, oh, 5 or 6 years at least, I should think."
"You've been here some time yourself, ma'am,"
said Chief Inspector Davy, suddenly putting in a word.
"I have been here, let me think, 14 years," said Miss Gorringe.
"It's a nice place," repeated Davy again.
"And Canon Pennyfather usually stayed here when he was in London, is that right?"
"Yes, he always came to us. He wrote well beforehand to retain his room. He was much less vague on paper than he was in real life. He asked for a room from the 17th to the 21st. During that time he expected to be away for 1 or 2 nights, and he explained that he wished to keep his room on while he was away. He quite often did that."
"When did you begin to get worried about him?" asked Campbell.
"Well, I didn't really. Of course it was awkward.
You see, his room was let on from the 23rd, and when I realised, I didn't at first, that he hadn't come back from Lugano. "I've got Lucerne here in my notes," said Campbell. "Yes, yes, I think it was Lucerne. Some archaeological congress or other. Anyway, when I realised he hadn't come back here and that his luggage was still here waiting in his room, it made things rather awkward. You see, we are very booked up at this time of year, and I had someone else coming into his room. The Honourable Mrs. Saunders, who lives at Lyme Regis, she always has that room. And then his housekeeper ran up, and she was worried." "The housekeeper's name is Mrs. McCrae, so I understand from Archdeacon Simmons. Do you know her?" "Not personally, no, but I have spoken to her on the telephone once or twice. She is, I think, a very reliable woman. She's been with Canon Pennyfather for some years. She was worried, naturally. I believe she and Archdeacon Simmons got in touch with near friends and relations. But they knew nothing of Canon Pennyfather's movements, and since he was expecting the Archdeacon to stay with him, it certainly seemed very odd, in fact it still does, that the Canon should not have returned home."
"Is this Canon usually as absent-minded as that?" asked Father.
Miss Gorringe ignored him.
This large man, presumably the accompanying sergeant, seemed to her to be pushing himself forward a little too much.
"And now I understand," continued Miss Gorringe in an annoyed voice, "and now I understand from Archdeacon Simmons that the Canon never even went to this conference in Lucerne."
"Did he send any message to say he wouldn't go?"
"I don't think so, not from here. No telegram or anything like that. I really know nothing about Lucerne. I am really only concerned with our side of the matter. It has got into the evening papers, I see, the fact that he is missing, I mean. They haven't mentioned he was staying here. I hope they won't. We don't want the press here. Our visitors wouldn't like that at all. If you can keep them off us, Inspector Campbell, we should be very grateful. I mean, it's not as if he had disappeared from here."
"His luggage is still here?"
"Yes, in the baggage room. If he didn't go to Lucerne, have you considered the possibility of his being run over, something like that?"
"Nothing like that has happened to him."
"It really does seem very, very curious," said Miss Gorringe, a faint flicker of interest appearing in her manner to replace the annoyance. "I mean, it does make one wonder where he could have gone, and why."
Father looked at her comprehendingly.
"Of course," he said, "you've only been thinking of it from the hotel angle. Very natural."
"I understand," said Inspector Campbell, referring once more to his notes, "that Canon Pennyfather left here about 6:30 on the evening of Thursday the 19th. He had with him a small overnight bag, and he left here in a taxi, directing the commissionaire to tell the driver to drive to the Athenaeum Club." Miss Gorringe nodded her head.
"Yes, he dined at the Athenaeum Club. Archdeacon Simmons told me that that was the place he was last seen."
There was a firmness in Miss Gorringe's voice as she transferred the responsibility of seeing the Canon last from Bertram's hotel to the Athenaeum Club.
"Well, it's nice to get the facts straight," said Father in a gentle, rumbling voice. "We've got 'em straight now. He went off with his little blue BOAC bag, or whatever he'd got with him. It was a blue BOAC bag, yes. He went off, and he didn't come back. And that's that."
"So, you see, really, I cannot help you," said Miss Gorringe, showing a disposition to rise to her feet and get back to work.
"It doesn't seem as if you could help us," said Father. "But someone else might be able to," he added.
"Someone else?"
"Why, yes," said Father. "One of the staff, perhaps."
"I don't think anyone knows anything, or they would certainly have reported it to me.
Well, perhaps they might, perhaps they mightn't. What I mean is, they'd have told you if they'd distinctly known anything, but I was thinking more of something he might have said.
What sort of thing? Said Miss Gorringe, looking perplexed.
Oh, just some chance word that might give one a clue. Something like, I'm going to see an old friend tonight that I haven't seen since we met in Arizona, something like that. Or, I'm going to stay next week with a niece of mine for her daughter's confirmation. With absent-minded people, you know, clues like that are a great help. They show what was in the person's mind. It may be that after his dinner at the Athenaeum he gets into a taxi and thinks, now where am I going? And having got, say, the confirmation in his mind, thinks he's going off there.
Well, I see what you mean, said Miss Gorringe doubtfully. It seems a little unlikely.
Oh, one never knows one's luck, said Father cheerfully. There are various guests here. I suppose Canon Pennyfather knew some of them since he came here fairly often.
Oh, yes, said Miss Gorringe. Let me see now. I've seen him talking to, Lady Selina Hazy. Then there was the Bishop of Norwich. They're old friends, I believe. They were at Oxford together. And Mrs. Jameson and her daughters? They come from the same part of the world. Oh, yes, quite a lot of people.
You see, said Father, he might have talked to one of them. He might have just mentioned some little thing that would give us a clue. Is there anyone staying here now that the canon knew fairly well?
Miss Gorringe frowned in thought.
Well, I think General Radley is still here. And there's an old lady who came up from the country who used to stay here as a girl, so she told me. Let me see, I can't remember her name at the moment, but I can find it for you. Oh, yes, Miss Marple, that's her name. I believe she knew him.
Well, we could make a start with those two. And there'd be a chambermaid, I suppose.
Oh, yes, said Miss Gorringe. But she has been interviewed already by Sergeant Waddell.
I know, but not perhaps from this angle. What about the waiter who attended on his table? Or the head waiter?
There's Henry, of course, said Miss Gorringe.
Who's Henry? Asked Father.
Miss Gorringe looked almost shocked. It was to her impossible that anyone should not know Henry.
"Henry has been here for more years than I can say," she said. "You must have noticed him serving teas as you came in."
"Kind of personality," said Davy. "I remember noticing him."
"I don't know what we should do without Henry," said Miss Gorringe with feeling. "He really is wonderful. He sets the tone of the place, you know."
"Perhaps he might like to serve some tea to me," said Chief Inspector Davy.
Muffins I saw he'd got there.
I'd like a good muffin again.
Certainly, if you like, said Miss Gorringe rather coldly. Shall I order two teas to be served to you in the lounge? She added, turning to Inspector Campbell.
That would, the inspector began, when suddenly the door opened and Mr. Humphreys appeared in his Olympian manner. He looked slightly taken aback, then looked inquiringly at Miss Gorringe. Miss Gorringe explained.
"These are two gentlemen from Scotland Yard, Mr. Humphreys," she said.
"Detective Inspector Campbell," said Campbell.
"Oh, yes. Yes, of course," said Mr. Humphreys. "The matter of Canon Pennyfather, I suppose. A most extraordinary business. I hope nothing's happened to him, poor old chap."
"So do I," said Miss Gorringe. "Such a dear old man."
"One of the old school," said Mr. Humphreys approvingly.
"You seem to have quite a lot of the old school here," observed Chief Inspector Davy.
I suppose we do, said Mr. Humphreys. "Yes, in many ways we are quite a survival."
"We have our regulars, you know," said Miss Gorringe. She spoke proudly. "The same people come back year after year. We have a lot of Americans, people from Boston and Washington."
Very quiet, nice people. They like our English atmosphere, said Mr. Humphreys, showing his very white teeth in a smile. Father looked at him thoughtfully. Inspector Campbell said, You're quite sure that no message came here from the cannon? I mean, it might have been taken by someone who forgot to write it down or to pass it on. Telephone messages are always taken down most carefully, said Miss Gorringe, with ice in her voice. I cannot conceive it possible that a message would not have been passed on to me or to the appropriate person on duty. She glared at him. Inspector Campbell looked momentarily taken aback. We've really answered all these questions before, you know, said Mr. Humphreys, also with a touch of ice in his voice. We gave all the information at our disposal to your sergeant. I can't remember his name for the moment. Father stirred a little and said in a kind of homely way, Well, you see, things have begun to look rather more serious. It looks like a bit more than absent-mindedness. That's why I think it would be a good thing if we could have a word or two with those two people you mentioned, General Radley and Miss Marple. You want me to arrange an interview with them? Mr. Humphreys looked rather unhappy. General Radley's very deaf. I don't think it will be necessary to make it too formal, said Chief Inspector Davy. We don't want to worry people. You can leave it quite safely with us. Just point out those two you mentioned. There is just a chance, you know, that Canon Pennyfather might have mentioned some plan of his, or some person he was going to meet at Lucerne, or who was going with him to Lucerne. Anyway, it's worth trying. Mr. Humphreys looked somewhat relieved. Nothing more we can do for you? He asked. I'm sure you understand that we wish to help you in every way. Only you do understand how we feel about any press publicity. Quite, said Inspector Campbell. And I'll just have a word with the chambermaid, said Father. Certainly, if you like. I doubt very much whether she can tell you anything. Probably not, but there might be some detail, some remark the canon made about a letter or an appointment. One never knows. Mr. Humphreys glanced at his watch. She'll be on duty at 6, he said, second floor. Perhaps in the meantime you'd care for tea? Suits me, said Father promptly. They left the office together. Miss Gorringe said, General Radley will be in the smoking room, the first room down that passage on the left. He'll be in front of the fire there with the Times, I think, she added discreetly. He might be asleep. You're sure you don't want me to? No, no. I'll say to it, said Father. And what about the other one, the old lady? She's sitting over there by the fireplace, said Miss Gorringe. The one with white fluffy hair and the knitting, said Father, taking a look. Might almost be on the stage, mightn't she? Everybody's universal great-aunt. Great-aunts aren't much like that nowadays, said Miss Gorringe. Nor grandmothers, nor great-grandmothers, if it comes to that. We had the Marchioness of Barlow in yesterday. She's a great-grandmother. Honestly, I didn't know her when she came in. Just back from Paris. Her face a mask of pink and white, and her hair platinum blonde. And I suppose an entirely false figure, but it looked wonderful. Ah, said Father. I prefer the old-fashioned kind myself. Well, thank you, ma'am.
End of Disc 3.